But last time I gave you this passage, an introduction to how wonderfully God has designed our galaxy and placed our planet in the right spot in that galaxy. It's Proverbs 3, verse 19, "By wisdom the Lord laid the earth's foundations. By understanding he set the heavens in place." And I made a comment, because what we're doing here in the class is actually going through the entire Bible and looking at every major creation text. And I made the comment last week that whenever you see a creation text in the Bible, it's always linked to a text on redemption. And I said, well, what about this passage? And I said, well, look what it says immediately before. It's speaking about wisdom and God's Holy Spirit. It says, "She is a tree of life to those who embrace her. Those who lay hold of her will be blessed." Now, I think a good cross-reference to that is what you see in Hebrews 11:6. And, you know, Bob, you were talking about the four spiritual laws. And the first of those laws is drawn from Hebrews 11:6. You know, what's the first of the four spiritual laws? God loves you and has a wonderful plan for his life. What does it say in Hebrews 11:6? "Anyone who comes to God must believe that he exists, and he rewards those who earnestly seek him." But how can we know whether or not God exists unless we actually look out at the creation? And this is why everywhere in the Bible we see a creation text, it's always linked to a redemptive text. And so here's talking about God laying the earth's foundations by putting the heavens in place, and if we examine that and embrace what we see, we will lay hold of God and we will be blessed by him. So, just a little reminder here, whenever you see a creation text, look immediately before or immediately thereafter, and you'll see a text on redemption. And it all goes back to 2 Timothy 1:9. "The grace of God that we now experience was put into effect before the beginning of time." Before God created anything, he had redemption in mind. He had grace in mind. The hope that we share in Jesus Christ, Titus 1:2, was given to us before the beginning of time. All right. Last week, if we could dim a couple of the lights here, this will help. Last week, we talked a little bit about how special our galaxy is. Now, a lot of you asked me afterwards, this is not a photograph. This has got to be an artistic rendition. And wasn't the artist taking license and making the galaxy look a lot more symmetrical than it is? Well, of course, this is an artist rendition. There's no way you can go up in a satellite, get above our galaxy, and look down. You'd have to go out a good 200,000 light years, and that would take you 200,000 years to take the photo. So that's not what this is. On the other hand, this is a very accurate depiction of our Milky Way galaxy. What astronomers have been doing is looking through our galaxy, mapping its galactic arms, doing it at many different wavelengths. So, for example, when we observe at radio wavelengths, those radio waves go right through the dust, and we can actually get a complete picture of all the spiral arms. And as we combine that with X-ray and ultraviolet infrared radiation, we can actually map all the details of what lies along these spiral arms. Now, if you recall last Sunday we got together, I showed you just how atypical our galaxy is. Now, this is what's called the Grand Spiral Galaxy. It's the Pinwheel Galaxy, and it's one of the most symmetrical galaxies, spiral galaxies we can see. But notice, it's very different from our Milky Way galaxy. Because what you notice with our Milky Way galaxy, we have these arms that are circular spiral. Not the case with the Grand Spiral Galaxy, M51, the Pinwheel Galaxy. What you notice is that rather than a grand circular spiral arms, they're more stretched out, kind of ellipsoidal. You also notice that they're distorted. And so we see these big spurs that run through and these feathers all the way through, and that would be a problem for advanced life. So I mentioned last Sunday, life is only possible in a spiral galaxy. Only 6% of the galaxies in our area are spirals, 94% are not. Why need a spiral galaxy? It's important that the stars be stretched far apart. Your typical galaxy, they're all jammed tightly together, and the density of stars is so extreme that it will disrupt the orbits of planets going about a star. So you want to be in a spiral galaxy, but you don't want to be interrupted by these spurs and feathers. And so, moving on, this is kind of what your typical spiral galaxies look like. As you can see, very different from, this is a barred spiral like our own Milky Way galaxy. But notice how distorted the spiral arms are. And notice, too, that you have in most of these spiral galaxies these gigantic gas clouds, what we referred to last Sunday as the maternity wards of the galaxy. These pink spots are where stars are forming, and only star formation is able to sustain the spiral structure of a galaxy. And so it's important that we have these maternity wards. The problem is, in other spiral galaxies, there's a whole lot of them. They're very big, and they radiate destructive radiation. And also, if you bump into them, it will disturb the orbits of planets above the star. So here's another spiral galaxy. Again, you can see how the outer arms are highly distorted, or in this case, the spiral structure is almost entirely broken up. This is much more typical of barred spirals, where you just see that the feathers and spurs literally are filling in all the spaces between the spiral arms. This is a little bit closer to what our galaxy looks like, but also you can see that the spiral structure is highly distorted, where you actually see the spiral arms being bent one way or the other. This is probably the most symmetrical spiral galaxy we can see that is not our own. This is our sister galaxy, the Andromeda Galaxy. But I mentioned last week that the fellow who heads up Reasons to Believe for us in South Africa, he was the one that discovered that that dwarf galaxy up there actually went through this Andromeda Galaxy some half billion years ago, and as a consequence, the whole spiral arm structure has been warped and bent in such a way that advanced life is not possible. And so this is where life can exist. It's the only place that advanced life is possible, and this is why when we look at all those galaxies far, far away, sorry to spoil your enjoyment for Star Wars, but there is no galaxy far, far away where advanced life is possible. This is the only one. Now, in order for advanced life to be possible, our solar system must form in a very special place and then get quickly ejected from that special place into a safe place. And so, for example, we would need to form right about here, just outside the bar, in a very huge star cluster, because it's the only place we're going to get the elements that we need for advanced life. But if we were to stay there, we'd be wiped out. It's important we'd be kicked out to a safe location over here. And so this is a situation. Our sun is born in a gigantic molecular cloud. This is one of these maternity wards where literally thousands of stars are forming, and astronomers have calculated we must have been born in a star cluster with a minimum of 10,000 members. So it started off as a huge cloud of gas, and eventually the gas would be absorbed to make stars. But this is the kind of cluster we were born in, and we would have been born somewhat close to the center of such a cluster. Why? Because only if we were born in this extremely dense cluster of stars would our sun and its nascent planets be close enough to four different kinds of supernova eruptions. Now, where do we get the elements heavier than iron? We get them all from supernova. What are supernova? These are supergiant stars. And the bigger the star, the faster it burns up. But the really big ones, when they finish burning their fuel, wind up having a gigantic explosion. How gigantic? When one of these stars explodes, it will outshine 200 billion other stars. So it literally becomes as bright as the entire galaxy in which it resides. And it's that supernova explosion that produces all the elements heavier than iron. However, a type 1 supernova will make one certain suite of elements heavier than iron, but would be missing over two-thirds of them. So we have a type 2 supernova that makes some of the rest, but the bottom line is you actually need four different kinds of supernova to explode in the vicinity of the sun in order to enrich the solar nebula with all the elements we see. Now, those of you who have taken chemistry will remember the periodic table, 92 naturally occurring elements. We're probably living on the only planet that has the sufficient abundance of all 92. Unless you happen to be born in a situation where you get exposed to the elements produced by these four different kinds of supernova, as well as asymptotic giant bright stars, as well as a very rare kind of white dwarf binary, you'll not have the 92 elements. And if you don't have those elements, then advanced civilization will be possible. For example, there are about 30 elements in your body, and many of those elements, like tin and molybdenum and zinc, are these elements that are heavier than iron. Excuse me. All right. Now, here's the problem. If your solar nebula is too close to one of these supernova eruptions, it will be obliterated. After all, this is something that shines with a light of 200 billion stars. So you don't want to be too close to one of these things. But if you're too far away, you'll not be sufficiently enriched by the heavy elements that are made in the supernova eruption. So it has to be fine-tuned. You've got to be just the right distance from the supernova eruption. If you're too close, you get destroyed. If you're too far away, you don't get adequately enriched. And you got to do this with four. Now, how long does it take a supernova to explode and shower out its elements? It takes about 7 to 8 months. So that means you have to be fortunate enough to be in the vicinity of four different kinds of supernova eruptions, in each case where you're not too close and not too far away, and where you're not too distant in terms of the time. I mean, if you're late on the explosion, you won't be enriched. And if you're early on the explosion, you won't be enriched. It has to be just at the right time. That's why astronomers say it's got to be a cluster of stars with a minimum of 10,000 members, because if you don't have 10,000 members, there's a zero probability that you'll be in the vicinity of all the necessary stars that will super enrich you with the elements you need for advanced life. Yes?
What causes a star cluster? I mean, is it a design feature?
Okay, what generates a star cluster is this thing. You have this huge ball of what is called a giant molecular cloud. So it's a huge cloud of cool gas, cool enough that molecules are forming. And you say, why do you need the molecules? Well, the molecules kind of make the sticky stuff that's going to be critical for planets to form. If all you have is atomic gas, then you're not going to get planets forming. So you want this gigantic cloud of cool molecular gas. As it collapses under its own gravity, it forms stars. And then the stars heat up, and eventually the gas is all consumed, and this is what you have. Yes?
This is probably not only a dumb question, but do you think that God is up there kind of having a ball with his creation? Supernovas are like his fireworks,
Well, I'm sure he's having fun, but it's in no way random.
Right.
Everything is very carefully planned, and all of it is for making a planet in which human life can exist. All right. So, in terms of where in our galaxy you get the greatest abundance of the elements necessary for life, it's somewhere right about here. And so you want our planet to form. In fact, this is what the abundance of these life essential metals looks like as we go from the center of the galaxy outward. So at the center of the galaxy, you've got a medium abundance of heavy elements, but it dramatically rises as you get to the first spiral arm beyond the central bulge. And then it drops down to a minimum, then it comes back up again. Now, where you see these maxima is where you got a high star density, where you also have a lot of nasty radiation. You don't want to be there. So, bottom line is, it's necessary that our solar system form at that peak abundance and then get sent over here, where it would be safe. And so, in the next slide, shows you where our solar system was and all of its planets. It must have formed one of these gigantic star clusters in a dense spiral arm just outside the central bulge, and then it got kicked out to this spot here, the safe zone. So how did it get kicked out? Well, being in one of these giant clusters of stars, it's going to be in the vicinity of certain supergiant stars, and they exert gravity. And so if you got the right combination of supergiant stars in the vicinity of the Sun, it can act like a slingshot and kick us out of the star cluster. By the way, we use the same technique when we want to send a spaceship to Jupiter. I mean, it takes a lot of energy to get a spaceship to Jupiter. But what does NASA do? They wait for a gravitational slingshot. They wait until the planets are oriented just the right way that they can send the spaceship out with minimum energy, and then it gets gravitationally slung out to Jupiter or Saturn, wherever they go. Which is why you hear NASA saying we have a 3-hour time window in which to launch the satellite. Because if they miss that 3-hour time window, they will not get the gravitational slingshot that will send the spaceship to where they want to go with minimum energy. Well, the same principle works here. There's a gravitational slingshot generated by these supermassive stars that flung our star and its planets out at a high velocity and then got out to the safe spot and stopped. Now, as you move from here to here, you're passing through spiral arms. And so where we see the handiwork of God, it's crucial that this slingshot pathway avoid all the nasty stuff between the burst spot and the spot where you eventually want the slingshot to slow down and stop. And this is the thing that's amazing astronomers, because we really don't see anything here that would adequately slow it down. Something slowed it down. It's something they're still trying to figure out, but this is where we are right now. Yes?
But the idea, I guess, you almost answered the question that something has to slow us down out there, and that would have to be another gravitational slingshot that going around the other side that loses angular momentum at the fine-tuned amount to simply slow us down into a stable orbit.
Right. And the best theory that's out there now is that when we got flung out, we came into contact with a dense part of one of these outer spiral arms, and this had the effect of breaking the slingshot effect. And that being early enough in the history of Earth would have been okay if you're a bacterium. If you go back 3.5, 3.8 billion years, if bacteria were the only life forms on the planet, they could handle the radiation from that spiral arm, and then further dynamics would move this just inside this. And you say, what's this circle? This circle is what we call the co-rotation distance from the center of our galaxy. And it's Newtonian mechanics. The farther you go out from here, the more slowly this star will revolve around the center of the galaxy. But the spiral arm structure is like a rigid disk, and so it rotates. But the only place in our galaxy where the spiral arm structure rotates at the same rate that a star would revolve around the center of the galaxy is this co-rotation distance. And why do you want to be there? If you're there, you'll be moving around the galaxy at the same rate the spiral structure rotates, which means you'll be able to stay in between spiral arms for a very long period of time. If you're inside or outside, you're going to be crossing spiral arms. And when you cross a spiral arm, you'll be exposed to deadly radiation and gravitational impulses. Now, you don't want to be exactly at the co-rotation distance. If you're exactly at the co-rotation distance, you're going to experience what are called mean motion resonances. I won't go into the technical details, but the bottom line is it's going to push you this way or send you this way, and you're not going to be able to come back. The only place where it's safe is just inside the co-rotation distance. And that's where the Sun has been for the last 3.5 billion years. Just inside that co-rotation distance, inside enough that we don't experience a mean motion resonance, but such that we only cross the spiral arm once every billion years. When's the last time we crossed the spiral arm? Just before the Cambrian explosion of life. And so God waited till we crossed the spiral arm before he created any animals. And right now, we're exactly halfway between two spiral arms. So we're in the safest possible spot in the Milky Way galaxy. You had a question.
You were speaking about gravity. If the gravity is mass to the mass, why sometimes the distance is going to be increased instead of, so in the center we have the maximum of the mass, right?
Yes.
So why sometimes we have increasing the distance from the center instead of decreasing?
Oh, are you asking me why you have stars flung out from the center? Okay. Our galaxy is rotating, and so there's angular momentum that's going to be pushing star material out, and there's what's called a density wave structure, dynamics to spiral galaxies, where you've got gas being funneled into the center of the galaxy, and that gas comes from neighboring dwarf galaxies. To sustain that spiral structure and to keep the spiral structure arms far away from the central galaxy, our galaxy must consume a dwarf galaxy about every quarter of a billion years. And so, because if you stop consuming these dwarf galaxies, and what you say is right, gravity is going to collapse all those spiral arms. It only takes 3 or 4 rotations before the spiral arms collapse. And this is the thing that has amazed astronomers about a Milky Way galaxy. Because the reason why most of your spiral galaxies are distorted, if you consume a relatively large dwarf galaxy, that consumption will distort the spiral arm structure. What's unique about the Milky Way galaxy, it's been consuming tiny dwarf galaxies on a very regular basis, such that the spiral structure remains undisturbed for 10 billion years. The only spiral galaxy we know of that's got undisturbed spiral arms for 10 billion years is the Milky Way galaxy. And there again, I think you can see the handiwork of God. If we're randomly consuming dwarf galaxies, then that spiral structure either gets disturbed or, as what you say, the gravity will collapse it down. That explains, by the way, only 6% of the galaxies are spiral. Because most galaxies have stopped consuming dwarf galaxies, and for them, they collapse in what are called spheroidal galaxies, where basically all the stars in the galaxy, it collapses into a central ball. And so, because our galaxy is still eating dwarf galaxies, it's able to sustain the spiral structure. But if you don't eat them on a regular basis, kind of like eating a meal, you want to eat every 4 hours. If you eat every 3 hours, it messes it up. Every 5 hours, it messes it up. You've got to consume these galaxies at a very regular basis, and they've got to be small all the way through. Which means that not only do we live in a very special galaxy, our galaxy resides in a very special cluster of galaxies. If you don't have neighboring galaxies, you're in trouble. But the amazing thing about our cluster of galaxies, the local group, it is no supergiant galaxies. There's only 2 large galaxies, ours and the Andromeda Galaxy, and there's 100 dwarf galaxies that are still left to sustain the spiral structure. And if we look at our neighboring Andromeda Galaxy, it's been consuming dwarf galaxies. Unfortunately, it's been consuming big ones, and that's why it's got a distorted structure as opposed to our Milky Way Galaxy. Yes?
About how long ago did we get kicked out of our... from where...
Okay, the kick-out time?
The sun and the dust cloud or the sun?
We probably... Okay, the sun is 4.57 billion years old. We probably got kicked out at about 4.55. So very shortly after it formed, it got kicked out. However, enough exposure was there in that cluster that we got blasted by aluminum-26. Say, what's aluminum-26? It's radioactive aluminum. Aluminum-27 is the stuff you make pots and pans out of. And if you know anything about our Earth is super enriched in aluminum. I mean, the crust of the Earth is about 7.5% aluminum. Now, what's it like everywhere else? It's about 50 times less. So we have this huge amount of aluminum, which makes it possible to have kitchenware and utensils. But also means when the solar system was extremely young, it would have been blasted by aluminum-26. So where's the aluminum-26 now? It's all gone. Aluminum-26 has a half-life of only 500,000 years. But that means that when the solar system was young, we're being bathed in all this aluminum 26 radiation. What did that do? It blasted away the carbon, the nitrogen, and the water. Now, we're finding planets outside of our solar system. As of this morning, 1,795 have been discovered. We've actually found some planets that we call Goldilocks planets. They're like the Earth, same size as the Earth, and about the same distance from the stars as our Earth is from our Sun. However, as we look at the spectra of these stars and their planets, the planets are coming in with about 1,200 times as much carbon and 2,000 times as much nitrogen and about 500 to 1,000 times as much water. Now, you need carbon for life. You need nitrogen for life. You need water for life. But too much is not a good thing. So we're seeing these other planets that are like the Earth. They have these very thick atmospheres loaded with carbon and nitrogen, and consequently carbon dioxide, carbon monoxide, and methane. And what this does is creates a huge greenhouse effect that makes the surface of the planet way too hot for life. It also means it'd be impossible to breathe because the atmosphere would be so thick, it'd be like 1,000 times thicker than our atmosphere here. And even if you make our atmosphere twice as dense as it is, then lungs cease to operate. And so it's crucial that you not have too much. And that's one of the things we're noticing about our Earth. It's very water poor, very carbon and nitrogen poor. But it's exactly the amount of carbon, nitrogen, and water we need for life. And most of that water and carbon and nitrogen was blasted away by the fact that we were born in this very dense cluster and we were exposed to this very intense radiation from the decay of aluminum 26. Okay.
Did I understand you to say that we were kicked out, our solar system was kicked out about 4.57 years ago?
4.57 billion is when our solar system was born, and we're talking just a few tens of millions of years thereafter we were kicked out.
And so, but then we arrived about 3.5 billion years ago.
Oh, no. I mean, the kickout was very rapid, so we got here fairly quickly, but we were probably sent into one of these spiral arms, and it would have taken some time to settle into the safe zone.
And we settled in maybe, how many billion years ago?
Well, those numbers we're still trying to figure out.
Yeah.
So, I mean
you did mention just before the Cambrian explosion.
Oh, okay. So we settle into this just inside the co-rotation distance. Even if you're in that permanent, so we've been in this zone here for probably the last 4 billion years, maybe even a little bit more. We've been in this ideal safe zone. But notice in that ideal safe zone, you're just inside the co-rotation distance, which means you'll be crossing spiral arms very infrequently. But very infrequently is about once every billion years. Okay, all these other stars are going to be crossing every 100 million years or so. We only cross about every billion. Now, if we were right here, we wouldn't cross at all. But if you're right there, you're going to get a mean motion resonance, which is going to kick you this way or kick you that way. So if you want to stay put, you have to be just inside. So that's where we are, but that means you're going to cross spiral. So we've crossed the spiral arm about 4 times since we arrived in the safe zone. But what I was pointing out was the last time we crossed the spiral arm was just before the Cambrian explosion, 543 million years ago. Well, we probably crossed about 600 million years ago, which means that we're now halfway between the Sagittarius and Perseus spiral arms. And being exactly halfway between these two spiral arms is the time you want to have advanced life. And so Cambrian explosion, you're crossing a spiral arm and you're actually moving towards that safe zone. And so this is the time to have advanced life. But hey, if you're a clam, you can handle a little more radiation from these spiral arms. So what it shows you is that as soon as we cross the spiral arm, God immediately creates this huge explosion of these small sea life forms. And then at the right time, when we're halfway between spiral arms, he creates advanced life like us. Which means that God's going to have to achieve his purpose for humanity before we cross the next spiral arm. So I don't think God's going to have us sit around for another half billion years, because if we do, then we're going to be crossing a spiral arc.
This stuff is terrific, and it's so compacted. Where can we go to see this? Is this in your new book?
This will be in the book I'm writing right now.
Yeah.
So, no, I've written all this stuff, but it's not going to see the light of day for another year. I mean, so. Well, quite a bit of this stuff we're writing as short articles on our website. But yeah, we're collecting all this into a book that'll be released probably a year and a half from now. Yes.
Maybe it's like a filler question, a little bit off, a little bit not maybe. If we saw Venus and what we considered a Terran potential, the exoplanet, considering its potential Venus, a fairly close size, its molecular structure.
We are finding Venus twins, planets that are somewhat like Venus, in that they're about the size of Venus and they have a heavy atmosphere. They actually have a heavier atmosphere than Venus. Venus's atmosphere right now measures about 80 times denser than our atmosphere.
We know to eliminate it off because of our probes. The first Russian one melted, and et cetera, et cetera. But would we eliminate the potential life holders in other galaxies, other exoplanets?
Well, okay, when I mentioned that we're finding out that with these Earth-like planets that we have way less carbon, nitrogen, and water, those are the few rare planets where we can actually get a grip on their spectra. And how you do that is if a planet transits in front of the star, you can measure the spectral difference that you're seeing there when the planet is in front of the star as opposed to when it's not. And this way it gives you a measure of what the constituents in the planet are. Most planets that we discover, we don't have that data. And even the ones, most of the planets we're finding, that's because of the transit method we're discovering them. But it's really rare where you actually have sufficient light and sufficient amount of time where we can actually determine the composition of what exists on the surface of the planet and its atmosphere. So many times we're just estimating. Like for one thing, you can measure the diameter of a planet quite accurately when it transits, because you actually see a change in the brightness of the star as it hits the edge of the star's limb and then as it comes out. And so if you know the mass of the star and you know its diameter, that gives you its density, and the density gives you a rough idea of its composition. But there's a few places where we actually have some spectral data. But we're talking maybe 3 out of the 1,795 where we got that kind of data.
Yeah. It would be good to point out that our sister planet is Venus. Earth used to look like Venus before the moon forming event. Because we sent so many robots to Mars, a lot of people think that Mars is our sister planet, when in reality Mars is so small, Earth never looked like Mars. It used to look like Venus, and so we lost our thick atmosphere.
Yeah.
We know that any planet the size of Venus or Earth, which are similar, are going to have a thick atmosphere with lots of carbon, because that's what planets that size have.
Yeah, and that's something a lot of lay people don't appreciate, is how sensitive the planet's mass is to what kind of atmosphere you get. Because, you look at Mars and you say, well, Mars, it's what, 40% the diameter of the Earth, a little more than that. And you would think, well, that's going to be kind of like us. But because it's 1/9 the mass of the Earth, its gravity is sufficiently weak that it can't hold on to a lot of atmosphere. In the case of Venus, what is Venus? About 80%, 85% the mass of the Earth. So because it's so much more massive than Mars, it's able to hold on to a fairly thick atmosphere. Yes?
Did you hear, I just heard of that they were drilling in Brazil and they found this water thing?
Yeah, that got discovered out of Brazil. I think it was announced, in fact, day before yesterday.
So how would that affect if they said there's 3/4 of the amount of water under the mantle or the crust, I don't remember which, that was of what we already have, and how would
Well, we've known for some time that there must be a lot of water in the mantle, because if there isn't a lot of water in the mantle, then you're not going to have the kind of plate tectonics that our Earth manifests. what was announced out of this Brazilian core drill a couple of days ago is they've actually found tangible evidence of water in the upper mantle of the Earth. So our models told us it must be there. But now they actually have actual stuff from this core drill that tells us that there's quite a bit of water in the mantle of the Earth. And what our theoreticians are doing is actually showing us how that water got into the crust of the Earth. And so it takes giant asteroid colliding with the Earth to weather water-rich. So, for example, comets are about 85% water. And so if you get a big comet that hits the Earth and punctures the crust of the Earth, that can send water into the mantle. And so now they're trying to determine, well, how many of these events do we need? What does it look like? And actually, this is going to be going in the book as well. If it's called the late veneer, there's an event right after the moon-forming event that they believe is responsible for putting into the mantle the water that's necessary so that the plate tectonics will work without destroying life. And this is the amazing thing about the Earth, is that we have plate tectonics that is able to generate continents and recycle nutrients, but does it in a fairly smooth manner. Now, living here in California, you might not think it's that smooth. I mean, we get these magnitude 6 and 7 earthquakes all the time. It's not like it happens every day. But believe me, it's incredibly smooth to what you could anticipate on other planets, where you get what's called the stagnant lid phenomena, where the crust becomes completely stagnant. It doesn't move. It doesn't break up. And then suddenly you get a jolt where things are utterly catastrophic. And if that were to happen on Earth, all life would be wiped out. So fortunately, we don't get magnitude 21 earthquakes. We get magnitude 7 and 8 earthquakes. We can get a magnitude 9 earthquake. That's about where it tops out, magnitude 9. So because it only goes up to magnitude 9, life can survive. And the reason why we only get 9s and not something way bigger is because of water that exists in the mantle of the Earth. Is that water that actually allows the plate tectonics to go fairly smoothly. And by the way, when you're on land, it tends to be episodic, but if you look at these subduction zones in the oceans, it tends to be more smooth. Why? If you've got two plates coming together underneath seawater, that seawater, if it's at the right temperature and the pressure, will actually make talc. And that actually lets the plates lubricate. And so because of that talc, we're able to have aggressive plate tectonics and still have life survive here on the Earth.
Is all this put in the San Andreas fault for us?
Pardon me?
Can we get buy some talc and put it in the San Andreas fault for us?
That would be helpful. Well, this is why we get so many frequent earthquakes here in California, because the talc isn't there. But fortunately, we live in a state that's got lots of faults. I mean, literally, we have lots of faults. And because of all those faults, when the plates are slipping, the earthquake energy tends to be dissipated fairly quickly over fairly short distances. Much different, say, at the Madrid Fault and along the Mississippi River. Because there's so few faults out there, when that thing slips, it tends to devastate several states. Whereas, we had a magnitude 7.6 earthquake out in the South Desert here of California, and we didn't even feel it here. Well, we felt a little bit here in L.A., but no dishes dropped off our kitchen cabinets. I don't know about you. But if that had happened in any other state except California, it would have been very destructive. So thank God for all the faults we have here in California.
All this mantle stuff in your new book as well?
Some of it will be. I mean, Jeff Swerink is writing a book on exoplanets. He's going to have a significant chapter on all this design of the plate tectonics. What I'm putting in my book is how crucial life is to regulate the plate tectonics. And it's kind of like a paradox. If you don't have plate tectonics, you can't have long-lasting life, but you can't have long-lasting plate tectonics if you don't have life. And so there's actually a synergistic relationship between life and plate tectonics. Now, that I will put in the book, but some of this other material, there won't be room to stick in the book. I'm only allowed like 280 pages. So, yes.
I understand that the water, I think I read a little article on that water there that they found in Brazil. It's not in big pools or oceans. It's in very tiny little voids inside of rocks. And I don't know if it's liquid or if it's bound to the rock in some chemical form. I don't remember the details. Do you know anything more about that?
Yeah. I'm trying to remember the exact name of the mineral. But yeah, it's a hydrated mineral. So yeah, I mean, they're not talking about pools of water in the mantle. The mantle is way too warm for that. But what happens is as the water gets put into the mantle, it gets heated up and chemically reacts to make a particular chemical. And there is an article I wrote on our website where I talk about that chemical, but it's basically a hydrated mantle material. Now, when that mantle material gets pushed up to the surface, say through some kind of plume, volcanic plume or volcano, then the water is released. And so we can get water that's been trapped in the mantle coming up to the surface. So, but yeah, it's a hydrated mineral. And that's what they discovered. Yes?
It's sort of fun to think about hydrated minerals. The gypsum in our walls have 5 waters of hydration.
Yes.
So we actually have liquid walls, and that's why they like them for fireproofing. But water can hydrate and become a solid form as part of something else.
That's right. Well, in fact, these conical land masses that we're living on, they're hydrated basalts. So what you're living on is ocean seafloor that where water has been added to make silicates. And that's why we have continents that actually pop up above sea level. Because they're hydrated basalts, they float above the basalts, and that's what makes the continents. But without the plate tectonics, you're not going to get silicate production. If you don't get silicate production, you won't get continents. And indeed, that's what we see in Genesis 1. That when God formed the earth, it started off as a water world. And it was this plate tectonics, thanks to the introduction of life at just the right time, that transformed the basalts into silicates. And over time, those silicates built up, and we had caught the land masses in which we can enjoy life. And so we are sitting on hydrated minerals. But there's hydrated minerals in the crust, or in the mantle of the earth as well. Okay, but the point I wanted to make here is that Earth is extremely water poor. Now, to give you an example, the planets that we're discovering that are the most Earth-like, those where we can measure the water content, the minimum water content is 10% of the mass of the planet. The maximum is 50%. So some of these planets we're finding are literally 50% water. And you say, is that the top end? Well, actually, there's a satellite of Jupiter that's 65% water. Mm-hmm. Now, don't be surprised. Water is the second or third most abundant molecule in the universe, depending what you call molecules. H2 is the most abundant. That's 2 hydrogen atoms together. Then you've got CO, and right after that, you've got water. So very abundant in the universe. So these Earth-like planets, 10 to 50% water. What's the water content of the Earth? Between 0.02 and 0.03%. So we're extremely water poor compared to other Earth-sized planets. But it's because we have only 0.03% water that we have this thin layer of water on the surface, which makes it possible for our planet to have both oceans and continents on its surface. If we had, say, 1% water instead of 0.03% water, we'd be permanently a water world. Continents would never show up. So you might be able to have bacteria in the oceans, but you're never going to have vascular plants and animals that can wander around the land masses. Yes?
Is that by weight?
It's by mass. By mass. 0.03. Well, it's between 0.02 and 0.03. And that's one reason why we're so excited about this Brazilian discovery. It might actually help us measure, because the greatest uncertainty is how much water there is in the mantle. We have a very good measure of how much is on the surface and in the crust of the Earth, but we don't have a good measure of exactly how much is in the mantle. We do know there must be a minimum amount there just to keep the plate tectonics moving as efficiently as it moves. Okay. Now, you get to the safe zone here. However, Earth is still too water rich and too rich in carbon and nitrogen. And so even though we got blasted by all this aluminum in 26, we're still way too endowed with nitrogen, carbon, and water. So we got to get rid of a lot more. And that's what I'm going to share with you. It's basically a four-step process that explains how we got to become so carbon poor, so nitrogen poor, and so water poor. Step one is the fact that we got blasted with this aluminum 26, and that means that we had to stay in that cluster long enough so that this stuff would get rid of all the light material in the solar system. Then we get kicked out. But we're still way too rich. So the next thing that happens is the moon-forming event. So this is where a planet about twice the mass of Mars collides with the Earth when the Earth is about 100 million years old. So I'd say there was about 20 million years after we get formed here, after we get blasted by the moon in 26, that we get kicked out here. So once we arrive here, about 180 million years after, the kick-out time is when we have the moon-forming event, where we literally have two planets sharing the orbit of the Earth. You say, can that happen? Yes, you can have two planets on the same orbit on one condition. The smaller the two planets must be 60 degrees forward or 60 degrees back. That's the only place where you can have two planets sharing the same orbit for a relatively long period of time. Anywhere else, it's going to be destabilized. Yes?
But then how do they come together if they have to be 60 degrees forward or back?
Okay, if it's 60 degrees forward or back, you can actually have two planets share the same orbit, and it can be stable for billions of years. Now, it's stable for billions of years if you're talking a three-body problem. What do I mean by a three-body problem? Where you got the Sun, you got Earth, and then you got this sister planet sharing the same orbit, and astronomers have actually given a name. It's called Theia. So you got Theia and the Earth sharing the same orbit, with Theia 60 degrees back or 60 degrees forward. It's stable for billions of years if there's no other bodies in the solar system. All you got is the Sun, the Earth, and Theia. It's stable. But we don't have just those three bodies.
Is Theia the same thing as the Moon?
Well, Theia and collided with the Earth, and that's what led to the formation of the Moon. So we don't call the Moon Theia. That's what we call the colliding body, Theia. Okay? And but we got Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. And because of those gas giant planets, what happens is these gas giant planets actually exert a little more gravitational force on Theia. And because of that, Theia gets destabilized. And so it moves a little bit out of the 60 degrees. You know, it goes to, say, 59 degrees or 61 degrees. And once it moves out of that 60-degree spot, it's no longer in a stable situation. What happens? Theia begins to slowly creep from, say, 60 degrees to 59 to 58 to 57 and gradually moves towards the Earth. But the beauty of all this is that when it collides with the Earth, it collides with a low-velocity collision. You say, how low? It's less than 4 kilometers per second. And a typical collision in our solar system is 100 kilometers per second. So this is a very low velocity collision. And it's also a low velocity collision when Earth had a deep ocean. Because after all, they got blasted by the aluminum 26, but it didn't get rid of enough water. Earth at that time had a really deep ocean. How deep? Well, they figure it's probably about 1,000 kilometers deep. So quite deep. And so we got Theia smashing into the Earth when it's at a very low velocity, and also it's at a high attack angle, so it's not a head-on collision. It's not like two bodies coming together like this. Because they're sharing the same orbit, it's almost like a glancing blow. In fact, Robin Knoop has done the most modeling on this collision event. She has calculated that the collision angle was a little bit greater than 45 degrees. So kind of hit it sideways, into a deep ocean at a low velocity. Now, if it was at a high velocity, or if the ocean were shallower, the Earth would have been split apart. So that would not have been a good thing. But because it was at this glancing blow at a low velocity into a deep ocean, what happened was that there was energy being absorbed in this low velocity collision, so the Earth remained intact. And what actually happened was a transfer of mass, where all the heavy element material in Theia basically got sucked into the interior of the Earth. And then the light element material that was surrounding the Earth, like our atmosphere, our ocean, and the light stuff that was part of Theia, that all got blasted into outer space. And so, literally, Earth lost all of its water. So after that event, Earth was bone dry. All the water was gone. All the atmosphere was gone. And there was still some lighter material that was out there. And what happens is it formed the moon. And hey, have we got a video clip of this? I think, yeah, we got time to show you. If you want to see the whole thing, it's in this DVD that we made a few years ago, Journey Toward Creation. And this is the version that's in 11 languages. And incidentally, thanks to our chapter in Toronto, this DVD has been broadcast twice in Farsi into Iran. And they told me that it broke the record for email responses. You say, isn't it against the law in Iran to be watching foreign television? It is. They have very harsh laws for anyone who watches foreign television. And it's also against the law to have a satellite dish in your home. But what I hear from people I know in Iran is virtually every household has a satellite dish. And they share with one another how to hide it from government inspection. If you kind of design your roof the right way, you can put a satellite dish there that nobody can see from the ground. In fact, sometimes you can't even see it when you're on the roof. And so Iranians are able to watch satellite television. That's how we broadcast this into Iran, in their language. But this is in English.
Are there stations on the internet that broadcast Christian radio into Iran?
Yes, that is happening. Okay, let me move this forward. And if you've watched the DVD before, you'll have seen this.
Moon exploration enabled us to confirm that lunar rocks differed chemically from Earth rocks. Through study of lunar rocks' radioactive decay, researchers discovered that the moon is in fact nearly 100 million years younger than the Earth. In the 1990s, a theory explaining the moon's existence gained wide acceptance in the scientific community. According to this theory, an object the size of Mars crashed into the newly forming Earth about 4.5 billion years ago. Most of the object's mass was absorbed by the Earth, but this collision also sent up a huge cloud of dust and rocky fragments all around the Earth. In time, gravity pulled those fragments together into one solid body, the moon. The Earth, meanwhile, lost its entire atmosphere, and a new, much thinner one began to form from gases released by Earth's crustal material. Such a collision may seem a disaster, but it proved just the opposite. It set in motion certain alterations to Earth's features that eventually made this planet a uniquely suitable site for life. The odds against a collision benefiting the eventual support of human life are staggering. The planet colliding with the Earth would need to be the right size, moving at the right velocity, striking at the right angle, made of the right materials, and occurring at the right time in the development of planet Earth. If any one of these factors were off by just a few percent, the Earth would be barren today. Unless that impact had occurred, Earth's atmosphere would be much heavier than it is, even heavier than that of our neighboring planet, Venus. Venus's thick carbon dioxide-filled atmosphere would mean instant death for all possible life. The extra mass Earth gained from the collision, along with its atmospheric revision, meant that water could exist on Earth in all three states: ice, liquid, and vapor.
Yeah, you can read a lot more about that in the Navigating Genesis book, yes. Yes, that's true. Yep, and you'll see that all in this new book. It'll be out in a year and a half. That discovery that they found isotopes that actually proved that the moon did form as a result of these two bodies colliding with one another. Now, this video clip comes from NASA. It's a few years old, and the data has now been revised. Remember I was saying there it was the planet was the mass of Mars. They now know it's at least twice the mass of Mars. It might even be three or three and a half times the mass of Mars, a collider event. And you can read an article on our website, namely that as they've looked at all this, remember how I closed it off by saying it's got to be just right in all these different ways? Yes.
When you say at a low velocity, what is that?
4 kilometers per second or less. It's probably somewhere between 1 and 3.5 kilometers per second is how fast it was going. And let's see if I can translate into... Well, why does somebody here work out how many miles per hour that is? That'd be a fun exercise. So, but it is a low-velocity collision.
0.6 to 2.4.
Pardon me?
0.6 to 2.4 miles per hour.
Miles per hour.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
Per second,
yeah. You're going to multiply that.
3,600.
Okay. So it's still pretty fast, but keep in mind when an asteroid hits the Earth or a meteor hits the Earth, it's moving at 100 kilometers a second. So this is at least 25 times slower, and it may be a lot more slowly hitting the Earth than that. So, but we now know the collider was a little bit bigger. And you'll see an article on our website that I wrote a few months ago where three different research teams looked at all this and said, they concluded like I did here. There's a lot of fine-tuning going on here to make life possible. Is there some way we can look at this moon-forming event where we don't have all this design built into it? This is all published in a special issue of Nature. It made the cover of Nature. And they had these different three research teams comment on their latest research. But they also wrote philosophical pieces as well, which is rather rare for Nature to do, but they felt it was justified. But the bottom line is they wound up concluding, you know, we tried to get rid of the design or at least make it a lot less. Our models now show that we underestimated the design. It's even more fine-tuned than we thought of in the first place. And yay God. And they didn't say that, though. What they said in their commentary was, this is causing philosophical disquiet amongst our midst. That's about the closest they came to giving God the credit. So.
And isn't that the track record of science? There's always more.
Yep.
Well, as I said, the more we learn about the moon and the way it formed, the more fine-tuning we're discovering. And this is what's causing the philosophical disquiet. They thought surely with more advanced knowledge of the moon-forming event, we would see there is a natural pathway for it to form. But it's going exactly the opposite direction. The more we learn, the more exquisite and the more detailed and complex. In fact, that was another commentary where they said, you know, the more we study the moon-forming event, the more complex it appears to be. Anyway, we want to see the direct quotes. It's all in that article on our website. Yes?
It's aluminum 26 that we got zapped with so much. And we've got a lot of aluminum 27 now, but what happened to that aluminum 26? What did it turn into?
Well, it does decay. I forget what the decay products are.
But it's not aluminum 27.
No, it doesn't decay into aluminum 27. It decays into something else. Some of it might decay. I'll have to look that up and see what it actually decays into. But because we see so much aluminum in the crust of the Earth, we know we must have really been blasted by it. Because you can't get a lot of aluminum 27 without having a lot of aluminum 26.
Yeah. So in fact, we have a lot of aluminum 27, just implies there was a lot of aluminum 26 by the same event, causing both isotopes.
Well, that's one way we know. The other way we know is all the solar system planets are denuded of light molecules and light atom, light elements. And the only way you can explain why we got so few of these elements and molecules, we had to be blasted by short half-life radiation. By the way, it's not just aluminum 26. We also got blasted by iron 60. So when a supernova explodes, it throws out a lot of aluminum 60, also throws out a lot of radioactive nickel, and all these isotopes have short half-lives in the millions of years or less. But the biggest blast we got was from the aluminum 26. So that also explains why we're so iron rich. If you got a lot of iron 60, you're going to have a lot of iron 56.
Iron is in lots of fruits and vegetables.
Well, it's also a lot of it in the crust of the earth. Earth is extremely iron rich. So fortunately, we don't have a whole lot in the crust. If we had a lot of iron in the crust, then you'd be consuming too much iron in your diet. And so, yeah, you do need iron in your diet, but don't overdo the iron pills. Because if you do, it's going to cause problems for your internal organs. That's right. Yeah, the microbes put it in the right form. Because, yeah, in the early Earth, we had a lot of iron, but a lot of it was in soluble form. And if you got a lot of iron in soluble form, it's poisonous to advanced life. But it's thanks to sulfate-reducing bacteria, it ate all that iron and transformed it in insoluble form, and so we don't have too much soluble iron in our environment to kill us. We have just the right level, and in addition, we've got all these iron ores that we can mine to build skyscrapers and drive automobiles. So as I mentioned before, you really do need to thank God for 3 billion years of sulfate-reducing bacterial activity, because otherwise we wouldn't have ores to mine, and we'd be poisoned by all these heavy metals. Okay. So now we've gotten through the moon-forming event. We got the Earth. Theia is gone. And we have the moon. And thanks to the moon, we have a stable rotation axis tilt. If the moon had never formed, our rotation axis would be doing this. And that would be catastrophic for advanced life. It'd even be a problem for primitive life. And in fact, if you look at, other planets. In fact, we're finding planets elsewhere in the solar system. Typically, we're finding is that they are getting tidally interacted with their stars. So if the moon were a little bit bigger than it is, for example, it would actually bring our rotation axis tilt to zero. Or if we were closer to the sun, our rotation axis would go to zero. What happens when it goes to zero? You don't get any seasons, which means the polar regions are going to be extremely cold. The tropics will be hot. In between, it will be temperate. You say, well, we could live there. We could live in a narrow strip along the Earth. But the problem, if you don't have seasons, is that you can't kill the parasites. And therefore, your crops are going to be a problem. Life is going to be a problem. You need those nice cold winters to knock out the parasites. And if you don't have winter, you got a problem. So we got seasons. And by the way, people have calculated what's the ideal tilt of the Earth's rotation axis to make for the greatest biomass and biodiversity on our planet. It's 23.5 degrees. We're right at the ideal tilt. But it's because our planet Earth, a small planet, has been orbited by a gigantic moon that we have a rotation axis that's stable. It doesn't do this. It sits right there. Ours is the only planet in the solar system that has a stable rotation axis tilt. But some astronomers have pointed out we're probably the only planet, period, that has a stable rotation axis tilt. Why? Because you have to fine-tune the mass ratio of the moon to the planet to get a stable rotation axis tilt. So if our moon were less massive, it wouldn't be able to stabilize the tilt, and if we're more massive, it would actually bring it all the way to 0 degrees.
I have a question.
Yes.
Where do they get the term El Niño for the weather phenomenon?
I don't know where they got the term. Obviously, it's Spanish. And the El Niño event comes off the coast of Ecuador. So my guess is that probably some scientists in Ecuador or Peru came up with that name, because yeah, whenever you get a hot spot just off of Ecuador, that will generate an El Nino and dump lots of rain here in California. By the way, we need El Ninos to keep our food crops growing here in California. It's been a while since we had one, and so there's actually a good chance we may get one next year, which might help fill up our reservoirs. There was a question in the back. Yeah, John. All right, so there's your answer. Namely, it's a child current. Instead of a big current, it's a small current. But, yeah, they think it's related to the solar cycle, but we've gone a couple of solar cycles without an El Nino. So obviously it doesn't happen with every solar cycle. And one of the problems is the last couple of solar cycles have been relatively tepid. So Perry need a fairly dramatic one to get one, yes. Well, one reason why you don't feel much in the way of seasons here in California is we're so close to the coast. And so, you know, water has a way of balancing out the temperature. I mean, you know, my wife's uncle has a home on the shore by Long Beach, and he says, I never turn the air conditioning on, I never turn the heat on. But all you got to do is move a few miles from the coast. I'll bet you most of you have to use an air conditioner once in a while and a heater once in a while. But it's not like my sister who lives in Edmonton, where she's got heating bills in the winter that are $700 a month. So, but hey, when it's 40 below outside, you're going to have to spend a little bit of money trying to keep your home warm. So, all right. So we make it through the late the moon forming event, but now we got the problem that the Earth is bone dry. There's no ocean. There's no atmosphere. That would not be good for advanced life. And so where do we get the ocean and the water from? And this is what we get. We get it from what's called the late veneer. What's the late veneer? It's a late residual of asteroids and comets that exist in the inner solar system. Now, if we didn't have that late veneer, the problem is the rocky planets, the inner planets, would be Mars, Earth, Venus, and to a lesser extent Mercury. Their orbits would be elliptical. So astronomers now recognize that before, right after the moon-forming event, the orbit of the Earth was fairly elliptical. And if you want to have advanced life, you need a circular orbit. Incidentally, this is something we're finding that's unique to our solar system. As you look at other planetary systems, once you get a certain distance out from the star, the orbits of the planets are highly elliptical. If you're not familiar with that term, it's basically kind of an egg-shaped orbit. You know, Newton's laws of motion, planets go about stars not in circular orbits, but in elliptical orbits, where it traces out an ellipse. But the amazing thing about our solar system planets is that the ellipse is extremely shallow. I mean, we depart from a circular orbit by only a couple of percent. So it's very slightly elliptical. What made it very slightly elliptical was this late veneer. Yes?
You've said that many, if not most, astronomers are believers in God in general. Is it because of this kind of fine-tuning data that just keeps rolling in?
Well, it's... Most astronomers would say they believe in God in an afterlife. I'm not saying most are Christians, but most recognize there's got to be a God out there. They also recognize that we humans have purpose. I mean, a good example of that, there was a televised debate between Stephen Hawking and Roger Penrose, who have been research partners for over 40 years. But it was Penrose who challenged Stephen Hawking and said it can't be just a deistic God. As we look at all the astronomy, we see that there's purpose in the universe. And there's purpose in the universe. We humans must have purpose. And then Hawking said, well, what do you think that is? He says, I don't know. So that's kind of where a lot of astronomers are. They see that there's a God out there, that there's purpose in the universe, there's purpose for humanity, which means we probably have an afterlife, but that's typically where it stops. Although I've also been in places where a lot of astronomers are Christians. when I spoke at MIT a few years back, I was introduced to the Radio Astronomy Research Group, 13 faculty and senior graduate students, 100% were Bible-believing evangelical Christians. The whole group was. And so I asked them, you know, what causes? And said, when you look out at the universe, the evidence is overwhelming. Now, in terms of the kind of stuff we're talking about here in class, most astronomers really don't look at this. When they say there's overwhelming evidence that the universe has been designed for the benefit of human beings, they're looking at the size scale of the entire universe. What I'm trying to do is challenge my astronomer peers to say, you already recognize that there's design at the level of the whole universe. How about at the level of our cluster of galaxies? And you heard me speak earlier this morning, our galaxy. Believe it or not, most astronomers have not picked up on the fact that we live in a very special galaxy. And just as the universe is fine-tuned, our galaxy is fine-tuned. And now what I'm sharing with you is not just the galaxy, it's the solar system. And this is exactly what I saw in Proverbs 3, verse 20. What does it say? That God designed the whole of the heavens, and He designed the foundations of the earth. So that's kind of what we're explaining. We're just basically taking Proverbs 3:20 and saying, if we look at our galaxy, if we look at the universe, as we look at the earth and its early history, we see that even there, God was intervening on behalf of us human beings. If He hadn't have formed the moon exactly the way He did, we wouldn't be here today. And if He hadn't designed the galaxy the way He did, and had us born in the right spot and sent to the right spot. And by the way, when I say we were sent to the right spot where it was safe for advanced life, if you look at why the universe is the way it is, you'll also notice that safe spot simultaneously is the only spot in our Milky Way galaxy where life is conceivable and where you can actually see all the galaxies in the universe. Anywhere else in our galaxy, you'd have a hard time even detecting the full extent of our galaxy, let alone that there's other galaxies in the universe. I've often shared that with my astronomy peers, saying, you're so impressed with all this design you see in the universe as a whole, but if our planet Earth wasn't in exactly the location it is within our galaxy, you wouldn't be able to see all that evidence. Do you think that God put us here on purpose so we could see all that evidence? Yes.
Unless you're just about to anyway, could you distinguish the late veneer with the late heavy bombardment?
Yes. The late veneer happens right after the moon forming event. The late heavy bombardment happens about 700 million years later. So, and it's caused by a different thing. So the late veneer is basically early in the history of the solar system. This is when all the planetesimals are being cleared out. And so this is the last component of the clearing out of the debris that was assembled to make planets. And how much of it is left? We're talking just 1% of the mass of the Earth. So it's not a lot of stuff. You know, take all the planetesimals, asteroids, and comets that exist interior to the orbit of Mars. It's only 1% of the mass of the Earth. But it's exactly what you need to transform the elliptical orbits into circular orbits. And if those orbits had not been circularized, advanced life would never be possible in our galaxy. But the other thing is, Earth, being the biggest of the inner solar system bodies, took a fair amount of damage from that late veneer. Now, the late veneer is nowhere near as intense as the late heavy bombardment, but it was critical to bring water and an atmosphere to the Earth. And so the little bit we got from that 1% of the Earth mass basically turned the Earth from being bone dry into having a thin layer of water and having no atmosphere into having a light atmosphere. And so we wind up with an atmosphere that's 40 times less massive and 80 times less dense than that of Venus.